3. Johnny lay in the dead grass on a knoll and studied the far-off compound through a pair of cyclo-infrared night glasses. He was worried about Chrissy. 2 months had gone by, and he felt their chances were worsening. The only blessing was that the winter snows were late, but not the winter cold, and the wind sighing through the night was bitter. The huge night glasses were icy to the touch. The binocular character of them made them hard to use. The two eyepieces, being cyclo, were so far apart he could only use one at a time. The faint light of the dying moon reflected from the snow-capped peak behind him and gave a faint luminescence to the plain. He was trying to see her fire. From this vantage point, he knew by experience that he should be able to. So far, he could not find even the tiniest pinpoint of it. The last time he had seen her, 2 months ago, he had piled the cage with wood, given her some wheat to boil, and even a few late radishes and lettuces, all from the old women's garden. She had a fair supply of smoked meat, but it would not last forever. He had tried rather unsuccessfully to cheer her up and give her confidence he himself was not feeling. He had also given her one of the stainless steel knives the scout had found, and she had pretended to be amazed and delighted with it, and the way it could scrape a hide and cut thin strips of meat. In all these 2 months, he had not heard from Turl. Forbidden to go to the compound, having no radio contact, he had waited in vain for Turl to come to the base. Perhaps Turl thought they had moved. True, they had put an emergency camp near the mine site down in a hidden valley. They had moved extra machines, supplies, and the 3 shifts for the load, and one of the old women to cook and wash for them. There was an abandoned mining village there, and it was a short flight to the load. The efforts to mine the vein were not going well. They had driven the steel bars into the cliff and tried to build a platform, but the wind, meeting resistance, kept flexing the rods at the point of contact with the cliff, and the section there would become red hot. It was daredevil work. 2 rods had already broken, and only safety lines had saved Scots from plummeting 1,000 feet to their deaths. 2 months' work in bitter and ferocious winds. And they had only a few pounds of wire gold to show for it. Gold grabbed, as it were, on the fly. This was the 5th night he had lain here and looked in vain for the fire that should be there. 5 nights before, not seeing the fire, they had sent a scout. There had been a row with the council and the others when they found he was determined to slip down there himself. They had literally barred the door on him. Robert the Fox had become cross with him and shouted into his ears that chiefs didn't scout. They might raid, but never scout. It was too dangerous for him. He was not expendable. He had argued and found the rest of the council taking Robert's side. And when other Scots heard the raised voices, they came and stood around the council, as they had a right to do, they said, and added their arguments against his taking senseless risks with his person. It had been quite a row, and they were right. They had sent, as a compromise, young Fergus. He went off like a shadow through the cold moonlight, and they waited out the hours. Somehow young Fergus got home. He was badly wounded. The flesh of his shoulder was seared like beef. He had gotten almost to the small plateau in front of the cage. The moon had set by then. There was no fire in the cage. But there was something new at the compound. Sentries. The area was patrolled by 1 armed cyclo near the cages, and 1 or more guards walking the perimeter of the compound. The guard at the cage had fired at a shadow. Fergus had gotten away only by howling like a wolf in pain, for the sentry supposed he had shot a wolf, common enough on the plains. Fergus was in the makeshift hospital now, shoulder packed in bear grease and herbs. He would get well, clucked over by one of the old women. He was triumphant rather than cowed, for he had proven the majority opinion right. The other Scots, singly and in groups, informed McTyler that the point was proven beyond any doubt. A chief must not go on scout. Raid yes, scout no. The parson had consoled Johnny. In Johnny's quarters, when they were alone, the parson had patiently explained,
"It isn't that they feel you can't do it, nor even actually that maybe they themselves couldn't go on if something happened to you. It's just that they're fond of you, laddie. It's you who gave us the hope."
Lying in the tall grass, using binoculars built for an alien face, Johnny did not feel much hope. Here they were, a tiny group of a vanishing race, on a planet itself small and out of the way, confronting the most powerful and advanced beings in the universes. From galaxy to galaxy, system to system, world to world, the Cyclos were supreme. They had smashed every sentient race that had ever sought to oppose them, and even those that had tried to cooperate. With advanced technology and a pitiless temperament, the Cyclos had never been successfully opposed in all the rapacious eons of their existence. Johnny thought of the trench, of the 67 cadets with pathetically inadequate weapons trying to stop a Cyclo tank and dying for it, taking with them the last hope of the human race. No, not the last hope, thought Johnny. 1,000 or more years later, here were the Scots and himself. But what a forlorn hope. One casual sortie from that compound with one old Cyclo ground tank, and the hope would be ended. Yes, Johnny and the Scots could probably attack that compound. They could probably wipe out several mine sites and even end this present operation. But the Cyclo Company would sweep in and extort a revenge that would end it all forever. Yes, he had a potential weapon, but not only did he have no uranium, he didn't even have a detector. He had nothing at all to tell him where to look, or even whether something was uranium. He and the Scots had a very forlorn hope indeed. He put the binoculars on maximum magnification. One last sweep on that sleeping compound way over there. Nightlights, green pinpoints under the domes, but no yellow-orange fire. He was about to give it up for the night when his sweeping glasses picked up the fuel dump. There were piled the cartridges that powered the machines. A bit distant, safely away in case of a blow-up, was the explosives magazine. Plenty of explosives for mining, but even blowing the whole thing up would not really jar the compound. And there were the battle planes, 20 of them lined up on a ready line. Across the transshipment area from the battle planes, and distant from all the rest, but closer to the cage area, was the breathe gas dump. The company didn't care how much breathe gas it stockpiled. In huge drums and small mask bottles, there must be enough breathe gas there to last the mining operation 50 years. It was piled higgledy-piggledy. It was never checked out. Machine operators simply picked up canisters for their canopies and masks. There was too much of it to require conservation. The glasses swept on. Johnny was looking for sentries now. He found one of them. The Cyclo was waddling lazily through the dark between the breathe gas dump and the transshipment platform. Yes, there was another one, up on the plateau near the cage. Suddenly, Johnny swept the glasses back to the breathe gas dump. Aside from a half dozen trodden paths, the place was surrounded by tall weeds and grass, and the undergrowth and ground cover stretched out to the horizon. He brought the glasses back to the breathe gas dump. Suddenly, with a surge of hope, he knew he had his uranium detector. Breathe gas. A small bottle of it would let out, through its regulator, the minute quantities required for masks. If one let a little breathe gas escape in the vicinity of radiation, it would make a small explosion. A Geiger counter reacted when the radiation activated gas in a tube, or so the old books told him. Well, breathe gas didn't just react, it exploded violently. Dangerous sort of instrument, perhaps, but with care it just might work. Johnny snaked back off the knoll. 20 minutes later, at the base, he was saying to the council, "A chief mustn't go on a scout, right?" "Aye," they all agreed, glad he had gotten the point at last. "But he can go on a raid," said Johnny. They became stiffly alert. I may have solved the uranium detector problem, said Johnny. Tomorrow night, we are going on a raid.